you very much, Chuck, and thanks for an excellent introduction to Mike. And you know, it's too bad because this is the first ASA conference that Mike has been at. And I told him that a tradition of our ASA, CSSA, SSSA annual meetings is that on Tuesday night, everybody goes out bar hopping until 2 a.m. in the morning. And it's clear you didn't take that to follow that advice. But the points I'll make here refer specifically to the issues raised by Mike that I won't cover in the 10 minutes I have to talk with you about my perspectives on the issue. But one point I'd like to make is that Mike seemed to emphasize energy efficiency as opposed to energy yield. And if we are concerned with land conversion issues and limited amounts of arable land for any purpose, the issue becomes net energy yield, which is the net energy ratio, energy out per energy in, times the yield. The second point I'd make is the biofuel mitigation versus biofuels and their ability to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions versus land conversion. And this is a magnitude issue. And I guess the best example is the oil palm system, where if you do a life cycle analysis only of the oil palm production, it's highly, highly efficient, huge net energy yields. But And greenhouse gas mitigation potential. But if you expand the boundaries to include land conversion in that analysis, it's very negative. And so so it is crucial that we're focused on both yield, productivity, and the environmental dimensions and impacts as well. And so what I often am amazed is that, you know, we often try for the perfect and throw out the good. And so here we have an emerging biofuel industry building out using corn, for example, and yet there's no cry or funding for explicit research to accelerate the rate of gain in corn yields so that we can limit production on existing farmland and meet the needs for food, fuel, fiber, and livestock feed. And explicit research that puts constraints on the goal, which is to achieve accelerated yields and reduced environmental impact that falls within the concerns that meet the concerns of everyone involved, including environmental organizations. And this kind of work, it has been demonstrated to hold tremendous potential, but yet I'm always amazed that as we're building out this massive biofuel system, no one is calling, not the biofuel industry, not the corn industry, not the environmental organizations, to ensure that we build this industry as a stepping stone to other forms of biofuels. The N2O issue is also important, but the paper mentioned, Crutzen et al., uses, as my colleague said, a very unconventional approach, and it's important to recognize this. They essentially model nitrous oxide at a global level and attribute the missing piece of N2O to fertilizer. And as opposed to the studies that look specifically at individual fields, for instance, the IPCC comes up with a much lower estimate of N2O emissions from agriculture based upon direct field measurements. That's it? And so I'm going to end, but I think we would all agree that a certification system is needed for all biofuel systems, whether they're from high diversity systems or low diversity systems, because we're interested in meeting the criteria that we'd like to see from biofuels, and that requires that our assessments be based on the best possible science.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken, for those remarks, and we're going to turn it back to Ken for his prepared remarks.
Thank you very much. Let's start with the slides. I want you to all suspend your disbelief. And I want you to imagine that you're somewhere in deep outer space on a planet where there are conditions that can support life as we know it. And this planet has vast renewable energy resources from a nearby star. But at the same time, it's getting hotter. And it's getting hotter because of increased greenhouse gas concentrations from the atmosphere, which act as an insulation blanket for re-radiation of energy back into space. And the effects of this are devastating. Ice sheets are melting, temperatures are rising, ecosystems are at risk, sea levels are rising, and most of the human population on this planet lives in coastal areas. At the same time, there's hope that humans can, on this planet, can stabilize their population. But it only occurs if average wealth of all 6.5 billion people on this planet today and 9 billion people in 30 years get much wealthier. But in so doing, it means that they move up the energy consumption ladder and they will be using vastly greater amounts of energy. So some options in meeting that need are clearly better than others. And we've got to be careful to not throw out the good in our search for the perfect. And survival and quality of life for this planet's human population depends on making wise decisions about how to satisfy this energy, a growing energy requirement in a sustainable manner. And the clock is ticking. Decisions today must be made wisely. So the challenge ultimately is to meet this demand of a much wealthier human population so that population can stabilize, because there's a linear relationship between female fertility and income, and it's a negative relationship, low income, high population growth rates. And we must do this to change the direction of environmental services. One option is low input prairie hay biofuels, among many. And so the question is this a viable option? I'm not a forage or prairie ecologist, but what I've done is look at the available information, particularly in the paper by Tillman et al. And it's for marginal degraded farmland. The purported benefits, as Mike mentioned, I'll just briefly mention them, maintains biomass yield with relatively small requirements for nutrient input. It builds soil organic matter. It has a diverse plant community that provides incredible habitat for a wide array of flora and fauna. And it has a high estimated net energy efficiency and a large potential for greenhouse gas mitigation. But based on this study, I come to the following conclusions. And that is that the study, if we look at the last point, should never have been published, because it did not provide the kind of scientific documentation that would be required, for instance, in the Agronomy Journal. And I'd just like to mention in some specific points. It is trying to model a system that is based on annual extraction of biomass, that is annual removal of biomass. We've heard that cellulosic biomass systems, the largest cost is going to be the harvest, storage, and transport of a rather bulky, low energy density material. So yield is important, and annual removal has to be a critical component. Otherwise, you need to move things far too much if you're cutting only every other year or third year. However, in the study, they only removed 3% of the biomass. And they burned the plots in the spring rather than removing the biomass in the fall. And therefore, charcoal is being returned. Perennial plants also retranslocate assimilates from above ground biomass to roots during that period. So to claim then that these systems are sequestering carbon when you've actually not been removing the above ground biomass is simply, it's not acceptable. Another fact is that the burning that they used affects plant communities, structure. So you're trying to study a system and you're treating the above ground biomass in a way that's going to change how that above ground plant community and species diversity evolves. Costs and inputs were grossly underestimated, because what was not included is the fact that they were hand weeding these plots 4 times a year to make sure that invasive species and other non-desirables were not coming into them. This clearly is not possible in large-term, large-scale production of biomass crops. Although legumes can be used to replace the nitrogen that's removed with harvest, there's an acidification problem, as the Australians have had to deal with over time on legume-based lay systems. And so there would be eventually, especially on these degraded soils, which is the purpose of these kinds of systems, to deal with marginal land, they're low buffering capacity. Eventually, lime is going to be needed, and it's another input in the system. And the claim that they produce more usable energy than, say, corn systems is just simply not true in terms of if you're looking at energy density, the amount of net energy produced per area, unit area. And finally, these results were extrapolated globally based on what I felt was a study that had severe flaws in it, and only conducted really on one site with degraded land. And from that one site, there was a global extrapolation. And again, I think in a journal with more rigorous evaluation within the discipline, such extrapolations would not be allowed. So at the end of the day, what concerns me most about this is the fact that we're allowing things to get published that shouldn't have been, that end up affecting science policy and allocation of funding priorities. And so at a time when we're building out this massive fuel ethanol system based on food crops, we're already planning for the second generation system that may or may not ever come. And we're not funding the kind of explicit research that focuses on ensuring that as we build out, for instance, the corn ethanol system, that it is built out in a way that doesn't cause hypoxia at the mouth of the Mississippi, that doesn't require an expansion of agriculture, that allows us to accelerate the yield gains, not stay constant on the same rate of gain. That won't do it, but accelerate it. And more than that, accelerate yield gains while at the same time you're actually reducing the environmental footprint of that intensive system. In my experience, it is possible to meet that challenge, but not with existing technology and not with existing funding. So I guess I'm concerned about publications that are very influential on policy and funding allocations that are based not on the best possible science, and actually divert our attention from the real world trajectory of what's happening today in the biofuel world. It's not helped also by seed company executives who are making claims, for instance, that we're going to double the yield of corn in 30 years, that we're going to make quantum leaps in drought tolerance, in nitrogen fertilizer efficiency, when in fact there is no scientific evidence to support it. And again, these seed company executives are having influence. Because if you're a policymaker and you're hearing that, you're going to say, why invest in other technologies? Because we are going to be able to accelerate yield gains. And the problem is that the clock is ticking. We have an immense challenge and an immense opportunity as agronomists and ecologists. We need good science. We need leaders in industry and universities and federal agencies to see clearly about helping us invest wisely to develop a world in which we can meet needs for food, fuel, fiber, and food and feed. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Ken. That was very interesting. And now I want to turn it back to Mike Palmer, who will give his rebuttal.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Ken, for an excellent talk. And at least three different people told me, I overheard people saying, well, I sure hope in this debate that they won't all agree, because that would be tremendously boring. And it turns out that I do agree with Kenneth on most of his substantial points. I certainly applaud the need for a certification system. And I also would hope that we would agree on minimizing sod busting, I hope eventually leading to a moratorium on sod busting, but I don't know if that's possible. And I also do agree that energy yield must be considered. I mean, that is a crucial issue. But again, we have to work about, as Kenneth mentioned, the good versus the perfect. If we're talking about our current systems, it is definitely a myth that that we're just using currently intensively used land. The biofuels crops are showing a dramatic expansion of acreage, causing quite a lot of damage worldwide. Some of it are the indirect effects. At the Ecological Society meetings, I talked with quite a number of forest ecologists from Argentina, and they were almost in tears because the forests that they were studying, virgin forests, were being cut down for soybean production. Why are they growing so much soy? It's because the traditional places it's to feed the Chinese, who are willing to pay good money for soy, and they're not getting soy from Midwest because the Midwest is going more to continuous corn production. So there's trickle effects of displaced agriculture causing environmental damage. I also, as an ecologist, of course, probably the most well-known plant ecologist is David Tillman, and of course, I have a great deal of respect for David Tillman. But at the same time, there's a tremendous amount of professional jealousy amongst most people for the people who are in head of their own fields. So seeing criticism of the leaders is not necessarily a negative thing from how we perceive things. The particular studies mentioned, I thought, was a very well-designed study for the questions it was addressed to answer. But largely at the last minute, he co-opted the study for trying to answer something which it was not designed to study. And then there was a lot of hand-waving and semi-convincing rationale to say that it really should pertain to biofuels. But I'm actually with Ken here, is that I found it interesting and intriguing and should have been published, I think, but I also do not think it should have been published in Science. It was more of a speculation-type paper. And what I would call for is more research, the added benefits of these systems are so great that it really demands more research, and not just on degraded land. We've got to think about maintaining high yields on good land with mixed species systems. The thing that worries the most is something that I didn't stress enough, is we've heard a lot about peak oil. And some people have claimed that peak oil has already occurred. In fact, T. Boone Pickens, one of OSU's biggest benefactors, has said that peak oil has already occurred. Whether you agree with this or not, is peak nitrogen likely to follow very soon? Of course, the Haber-Bosch process requires a lot of natural gas. Some of you may have heard that 2 days ago there were elections in Trinidad, which is one of our major suppliers of natural gas, and there's a fair bit of political instability accompanying that election. So the question is are we merely shifting the geopolitics of energy? Can we rely on a constant and very large quantity of nitrogen that would be necessary to feed our feedstocks? We really need to think more about homegrown domestic nitrogen, ideally from biologically fixed nitrogen. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And now for the rest of the session, we're going to open this up to discussion. And just a few words about the format. We have two microphones in the aisles there. Just take turns between the two. And I ask that you identify your name and your affiliation, and that you pose a succinct question. Please do not use this as a soapbox. You certainly can preamble your question, but let's keep this succinct so that we can move along and give more people a chance to talk. So, okay, the mics are open, and please take this opportunity to let us know your questions, and we'll open them. And also, please either address your question to a particular speaker or to both. If there's a particular speaker that you want to have, answer that. And then, of course, the other speaker will have a chance to rebut as well. Okay, yes?
This is Ray Weil from the University of Maryland. I suppose I should address this to Ken. What do you see as the role of winter cover crops in a corn production system, both for environmental and additional biomass production?
Is this on? Testing? Will they turn it on and back?
There we go. Magic. I think the best answer I could give is that what we need is a free marketplace of ideas with regard to what options we have for meeting the environmental criteria we'd like to see from biofuel systems, not just corn, but all systems, and set a set of standards, and then let and then fund it well enough, Ray, so that we have exciting, young, talented agronomists, ecologists working on the issue. And so my answer would be cover crops where they fit and where it's profitable. And remember, with the rising prices of commodities, we'll be able to consider options that were not considered cost effective before, so that many of the things, and I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges we have, not as ecologists, but as agronomists. We've been working for all of my career, which is 30 years now, has been a time where if you propose something slightly off the beaten path, the retort was, oh, that won't be cost effective. I think we're in a different world. Agriculture has much higher value, and I think progressive farmers can respond in ways we haven't dreamed possible before.
Any comment, Mike?
Oh, my comment is, even though we're presenting this debate as HILD versus LIHD, there are clearly many intermediates that are worthy of considering, and that would be considered a one step in the direction towards LIHD.
Okay, may I have a question on this side of the room?
Yes, hi, my name is Julie Wolf. I'm also from University of Maryland. My question is for both of you. I'm wondering if you can defend your low and high diversity systems in light of global change, in particular rising temperatures and increased drought.
Well, one of the nice things about a system that has potentially hundreds of plant species in it of extremely high diversity is genetic diversity as well as species diversity is the likelihood that there will be genetic resources present in situ that can respond. Of course, it's nice to get crop breeders involved with an HILD system, but often nature has already come up with the solutions for some of these problems.
And I'm not here. The role here is not to defend low diversity biofuel systems, but I think the important point to make there is that our best estimates of what the more recently built corn ethanol biorefineries, how they're performing, and with the updated information about how farmers are performing and producing maize, which is getting better all the time, that they do have a very large net positive impact on greenhouse gas mitigation. But like all biofuels and what my colleague Mike has mentioned, if we don't have other checks and balances in place, not only nationally but globally, to ensure that the ripple effects don't swamp the negative ripple effects, for instance, clearing of land in Argentina, it was mentioned, or the Brazilian Amazon, because of high commodity prices driven by insufficient supply of feedstock crops like corn and soybean. If we don't get a handle on those ripple effects, which can offset any benefits from the direct effects from the biofuel system here in the U.S., for instance, or Europe, then we've lost the forest for the tree.
Question on this side of the room.
Yeah, my name is Rob Harrison, and I'm a University of Maryland alumni, but currently at the University of Washington, and I wanted to ask about trees. They were only presented as the enemy. What about forests where you don't have to go in on a regular basis? You can stand back and wait and harvest a much greater amount per hectare than you could ever possibly do with a regular entry type of crop.
I think there's tremendous potential there. And as we know, many forests have evolved under conditions of chronic disturbance as well. And in particular, there's diverse systems of forests that would actually benefit from strategic removal of trees, if you're looking from the conservation ends. If I had to wager a guess, and this is a guess based on some experience with tropical systems, rotational harvest of in situ tropical trees might well yield high diversity. High yields, as well as maintaining some of the diversity. It certainly is worse for conservation than leaving the forest alone, but it would be a lot better than conversion to oil palm crops.
Yeah,
I can't comment on the energetics since that's beyond what I know of the system.
I agree, and my guess is that the first very large scale deployment of cellulosic biomass, biofuel systems, bioenergy systems will be from forests rather than grass species.
Question over here, please.
My name is Richard Lawrence. I'm with USDA ARS in Tifton, Georgia. And just a comment, I believe there is a large-scale cellulosic ethanol plant going in Georgia that's going to be based on forest products. My question, though, is, has anyone looked at converting CRP land to low-input, high-diversity biofuel resources? Because we have 10% of our cropland in CRP, much of it in the Great Plains, where your Mike is talking about these sorts of systems. And we haven't done anything with them except grow biomass and maintain it so we didn't get weeds. But is there any research going on to try and turn these into higher diversity systems that could be used for biomass?
There is some research. My main argument here is a lot of people have been turning towards CRP as if it's a free resource that's out there. That would be a big mistake. First of all, if you look at the map of CRP lands, most of it's in the very unproductive, arid west. Go out there, you have grass that's this high. Marginal land means marginal yields. And I think that's actually one of the big mistakes of Tillman is arguing, hey, let's go places which we know are unproductive and get biofuels from there. I mean, there's a little bit of, that's kind of an oxymoron in a way. However, there's plenty of CRP land in more humid areas, more productive areas, and converting that to LAHD is simply mowing it. It's not plowing it up, releasing all the carbon gains and all the nitrogen gains that you've had over many, many years. It's simply mowing it will maintain it as a high diversity system.
Okay, do you want to comment on the CRP at all? Okay. Question over here then.
I'm John Angus from CSIRO Australia. I'd like to ask both speakers to comment on the effects of liming. Now, we know that liming, the neutralizing effect of liming is associated with release of CO2. What I'm having trouble getting my head around is the relative effects of legume-based systems and annual crops, high-intensity annual crops, with their nitrogen sourced from fertilizer. My understanding is that the acidifying effects are due to product removal and to nitrate leaching. Can both of you comment on the relative lime requirements of those things at present and in the future as the well-buffered soils start to run down with increasing cropping?
Now might be a good time for a fire alarm. No, clearly things are so highly dependent on the particular soils that are present, and we need to have soil scientists very closely involved with all of these sorts of issues. The systems that I usually deal with are very cation-rich systems to start with.
I think that if we're talking about using marginal soils for these systems rather than the best high class, high productivity soils, then it's likely that the comparative advantage for location of these systems is going to be in the southeast, where you have long growing season and high rainfall in the continental United States. Unfortunately, these are areas that have older soils, more highly weathered, relatively low cation exchange capacity compared to the prairie soils in the Great Plains and Corn Belt. So unless we're talking about replacing existing cash crops like corn and soybeans on the good soils in the Corn Belt, and instead looking at these marginal soils, which is the most likely scenario, the lime issue is going to become extremely important. And quite frankly, because we have not had heavily extractive systems where you're actually removing the biomass year after year on soils that have perhaps relatively low buffering capacity. I think we don't know the answer to that important question.
Question over here, please.
Christian Peters from Cornell University. My question is addressed to both or either speaker, and it is, to what degree can we expect biofuels to meet future energy demand, and what does this mean for the priority that we must place on energy conservation relative to energy production?
I think Ken actually introduced that in one of his slides, is conservation is number one. Other sources need to come. Transportation biofuels, are a political reality. I mean, transportation fuels, for the near term, but we've got to wean ourselves towards other systems. One thing I will say that when people are ranking biofuels relative to fossil fuels, they're always using in their measurements fossil fuel use displaced. And that's the way it should be. I mean, of course, we should compare those numbers. But in the long run, to say that something is marginally better than fossil fuels is not a good way to go. We want to be substantially better than fossil fuels, especially in terms of carbon sequestration. So I would challenge people who are doing research on the subject is to present the results in terms of the actual net benefit or detriment of the environment, not just in relation to fossil fuel displaced, because being slightly better than fossil fuels is not where we want to go.
Yes, Christian, I think you've raised a key issue, and biofuels can only be a component of a much broader strategy for energy self-sufficiency and renewable energy and in addressing climate change. But in terms of magnitude, I think there's different ways to look at how far biofuels can go. And so I just jotted some numbers. Let's say we could get up to 14 billion gallons per year, which is double about what our current capacity is. And we use 140 billion gallons approximately. Correcting for energy content, because ethanol is only about 70% the energy of gasoline, so that 14 billion gallons per year would be about 8% on an energy basis of our current fuel use, which doesn't seem like much. But looked at another way, maybe we're not so concerned just about the total, but the imported portion of that. And we import 60% of our petroleum. So in that sense, it's 15% of the imported petroleum. And then let's say we do couple it with an aggressive mandate to improve fuel efficiency of our vehicles. Well, then it can become 30% of our imported fuel for use for motor fuel. So I think it's a progressive step and only a step towards a much broader strategy of energy self-sufficiency and use greater reliance on renewable energy sources.
Question over here, please.
Yes, Blake Sandin, Irrigation Agronomy Advisor in Bakersfield, California, San Joaquin Valley. Question to both of the members of our panel, but a couple observations, maybe towards Ken in particular. Ken is one of your former cropping system students from Davis. I think it's patently unfair that I now have more gray hair than you do. Second one is that I was actually, when I saw the topic of the debate and who was the protagonist and antagonist, found myself extremely surprised. As someone who has spent much of their career working on overall cropping systems concerned with world hunger, I think all of us realize that when we set up certain industrial parameters and directions, we get an inertia going that builds us, predisposes us to pursue a given direction until we've gone perhaps way over the edge we need to go. Given the fact that we need to increase our food production in this world by another 70% in the next 30, 40 years, and if we go the route of high input, low diversity, obviously energy efficiency wise, yeah, it makes sense. Free market wise, it makes sense. Corn growers, boy, that's great. The price of the corn's doubled, but also we have shrinking phosphate reserves. We have the whole rest of the problem. You get a premium for corn now. You're going to transfer a lot of that production off of some of the best soils, the most productive soils. So, how do we bring in our responsibility as agronomists for providing the world food production? Where are we bringing in some of the social aspects of examining this ethanol biofuel question?
Yeah, Mike, you always did ask tough questions. Clearly, the food versus fuel issue is more substantive than we often hear. Sleight of hand about doubling yields and massive quantum leaps in drought resistance and nitrogen fertilizer efficiencies, sleight of hand. But the fact is that one of the most damaging things in the way of achieving food security globally has been the low value of agriculture. And so when we look to developing countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, governments have been able to essentially divert resources from agriculture, and they were supported by World Bank and others because there was no value in agriculture. Crops, when you looked at the economics, it was not a high priority, or it didn't seem to be, if you didn't understand how agriculture is the foundation of so many things. But so the academic answer is that, from my view, that unless we substantially raise the value of agriculture globally, we're always going to be caught with not having enough resources devoted to the fundamentals that support a sustainable agriculture and meet human needs. In the short term, there's going to be terrible dislocations unless we plan ahead and see clearly and wisely. So what are the rates of gain in cereal yields that we can expect? That's going to determine the land base you're going to require. If you know that, it'll determine the other resources, the water, the nutrients. If you know that, you can make intelligent decisions about, well, what is a reasonable amount of arable land we can devote for producing fuel crops? And what other mechanisms do we need in place to ensure that food crops used for fuel does not impede our need to maintain food security and human health? Unfortunately, I just don't see it being approached at that level, neither nationally nor globally, and I think that's a big problem.
And Yeah, the short comment is I was greatly inspired by Norman Borlaug's talk, but eyeing the Brazilian Cerrado as the solution where we can grow vast quantities of food, imagine we do start plowing that up in a great amount. And I mean, sure, you can say that it's grasslands with a few twisted, stunted trees, but imagine the carbon that's in those soils. That's likely to accelerate our hunger problems as well as the global warming issues.